Now we come to the lecture of the 7th of January, 1924. There's a question in which somebody asks the question. It says, in most of the ants which are in forests, in the first story, there is a kind of honey or resin, and this is used by the Catholic priests as incense. I would like to ask the question, what is its composition? Dr. Steiner answers. Rudolf Steiner answers. In the resins which there form, there's the same substance there which is contained in incense, and it has no other value than that in this way one gets it rather cheaply. The ant heaps arise through the fact that the ant heaps with the formic acid and all sorts of things which they bring out of the resinous components of the tree, they gather their juices together and they separate it there. Thus you have not a kind of honey, but formic acid, but a resin permeated with formic acid. Another question asks a question about a house that was constructed of wood, which was really inferior wood that was decayed, so to speak, and after the house, 2 years after the house was built, they had bees there. And there's another question who asks about what happens to elephants. You can never really find the remains of elephants. Where do they go when they die? Rudolf Steiner answers. He says the elephants have the remarkable characteristic that when they feel death coming on, they return to certain caves in order to die in these caves. You see that this is connected with the fact that these animals have this extraordinarily thick skin. And what then is the significance of this thick skin? You see, the hard parts of an animal are those parts which to the highest degree are related to the earth. Even your nails in themselves are to the most degree related to the earth. And the elephant skin, it is so that it is extraordinarily related to the earth. And through that, the elephant feels right through his whole life actually surrounded by the earth, namely the earth in his skin. He feels himself very comfortable and only when he is surrounded by his skin. Now, in the skin, the elephant is continuously dying. Now, when his death begins to approach, and this is the characteristic in the case of elephants, these with the thick skins, so they feel, the animals have a strong feeling in their thick skin about the approach of death. They want still to remain within their thick skin. That is their instinct, and that causes them to find refuge in the caves of the earth caves. So you never find the remains of elephants in open fields. You always have to find that secret cave in which they go to. And this leads us to the point that animals, generally speaking, have more than man an inkling of their approaching death, and precisely more by those animals who are surrounded by thick skins. But again, in the most of animal manner, also again, in those particular animals, which even belong to the lower animals, which are small skin. Thus, for example, insects, which also are surrounded by horn-like skins. This is something new to me. I never knew that insects were surrounded by horn-like courtier skins. Anyway, let's proceed. And you see, with these small animals, you must already say the following. It is so that they not only feel their death, but also indeed, when they approach the death, they meet all sorts of things for carrying on. They do all sorts of things so that when death does ensue, it can do it in the best way. For example, certain insects withdraw themselves into the inner of the earth in order to experience their death there. Now you see in the human being the case is that man has purchased his freedom at the same time by losing this ability to have inklings. The animals have no freedom. Everything with them is unfree, but they have a strong capacity for inkling, surmising things. And they indeed know when certain dangers are threatening. For example, when a earthquake threatens, the animals wander out, whereas man is always surprised, taken by surprise when earthquakes happen. We are able to say it is for the man extraordinarily difficult to transpose himself into the soul of animals. However, in the main, the person who can really observe animals, the person who has a sense for it, who has a sense of being able to observe animals, he will absolutely find that the animals handle their life extraordinarily in a prophetic way. And what the characteristic which I spoke about is connected with these animals in their prophetic ability. However, one must not, when you consider animals, completely compare them with human beings. You must not impute the same motives with animals when animals do things to impute the same motives as humans have when they do things. And here we want to talk about something else which concerns itself with elephants. And precisely out of what we're going to tell you now, that which you ask will be still more understandable. You see, it has again and again been observed that let us say when you have a small herd of elephants and who are led to a watering place, perhaps to bathe themselves or to drink water. Now, some mischievous youth can stand there, and when the elephants proceed to that place, he can start throwing things at the elephant. Now, the elephant appears to be, in the first place, a very patient animal, and he does nothing about it. It seems as if it doesn't seem to affect him at all. Then, mischievous youth waits again when the elephants come back. And his intention is to again throw things at the elephant. But you notice this. When the elephant goes back, there in his trunk, he retains a whole mass of water. And when he sees the young man, he spritzes water over the young mischievous boy before the boy can throw things at the elephant. He just pours water, a whole mass of water, over the young mischievous boy. These things can be observed very repeatedly. Now, as a conclusion for that, you might say, Donna Vetta, the elephant is much cleverer than a human being. The elephant must have an immense wisdom when this insult which the young person has inflicted upon him by throwing things at him The elephant retains this in memory, and then he is able to revenge himself later on. Indeed, gentlemen, this sort of conclusion, which you apply to the action of the animal, that is absolutely incorrect. You must not compare that with the cleverness of human beings. When you, for example, a fly puts on your nose, on your eye, immediately you wish the fly away. You immediately it's an automatic reaction. You swish the fly away. You don't think about it. It's immediately a fly gets on your nose. Bang! You push it off. Now this is in science. They have a name for it. You know, science has many expressions for things, particularly when they don't understand things. They give them names, and here the science calls it a reflex action. And so you could say that one does this swishing away out of an instinct, to push things away, things which under certain circumstances can be very damaging. These things happen again and again with human beings. And so in such an action in which a man sweeps away a fly from his face, that is an action in which the brain is not at all active. The only those nerves are active which go to the spinal column. Indeed, if a person begins to think about something, here above you have his brain, then it goes something, when he sees that or this or that, there's a sight nerve, the nerve of seeing, that goes to the brain, and from the brain that goes to the rest of the organism, to the will, and that does something. However, when you do this swishing action, when a fly sits on your nose or your eye or comes towards your eye, then the nerve, if a fly approaches your eye or sits in your eye and you swish it away, then the nerve doesn't go into the brain, even when it's in the head. But what you get a nerve which goes immediately in your spine. And so without your brain doing any reflection, the fly is swished away, merely not through your brain thinking about it, but through that reflex action which is stimulated by your nerve that goes to your spinal column. It doesn't go to your brain. It's the spinal column which actually is responsible for this fact. You don't think about it. It's a spinal column which instinctively reacts when anything approaches us in this way, as when a fly begins to come towards your eye. Now you understand that we as human beings don't have a very thick skin, but we have a thin skin. Our skin is so thin that actually it is even transparent. Since the skin of man consists of three layers, the inner layer is a so-called corium, the true skin. Then there comes a layer which is the so-called malpiggish skin layer. And then you have the third layer, which is the external skin, which is already quite transparent. We also have a skin, just like the elephant has, but it is very thin and very transparent, like glass. The external skin is quite transparent. Through the fact that we have a skin which is transparent, we stand also with our whole sense of feel, the whole feeling sense. We also stand in contact with the environment. And through the fact that we are in contact with the environment, we are inwardly thinking people and reflect about things. The elephant now is a thick-skinned animal, also in the physical sense. Men are often thick-skinned in a moral sense, but the elephant is thick-skinned in a physical sense. What does that cause? Now, it's very easy for you now to conceive of the fact, what I have just told you, that the elephant is extraordinarily sensitive for his environment. So, an elephant... I don't get this. He says the elephant is extraordinarily empfindlich, sensitive for his environment. Then Rudolf Steiner says, so an elephant, he feels actually in the main nothing at all. I can't get that. And everything which he perceives of his environment, that he must see. The elephant is like a world locked up in itself. It doesn't make sense at all to me. Anyway, that's what it says here in the German, and that's why I'm telling you it definitely says what I just told you. Okay. Rudolf Steiner continues. The sole mood of an elephant to study it penetrating is for many people of extraordinary interest. Many time must the human being precisely extraordinarily wish in order to understand more of knowledge or mindekendis. What is saying in this sentence here, that many people, in order to learn more about the elephant, would like to be an elephant themselves. Because you see, if the human being, in addition to his power of thinking, had added to that, then he would, to be sure, be so clever that he couldn't tell the world how clever he is. Makes sense out of that one. But the elephant doesn't have his brain in order to become so clever. Through the fact that the elephant is such an abgeschlossen, an enclosed individual, then there is a lengthening of his reflex movements. His movements which are reflex, which tend to respond to push something away that comes towards him. This, his reflex actions, because he's such a self-contained individual, his reflex actions last much longer. So when you have a fly sitting there, and if you did not have so quickly the instinct to swish the fly away, so the fly would fly away by itself. With the elephant, the situation is now so that a fly, he would let a fly sit a long time on him because it would take a long time for him to get a reflex action. And that which the elephant does with his trunk is nothing other than such a reflex action, but which lasts a long time. Now, I believe what Rudolf Steiner is saying here is something like this. The elephant has a much thicker skin, and the human being has a thin skin. And with this thick skin, that he encloses himself into sort of a self-enclosed being. And so within that sort of self-enclosed situation, the elephant has a much stronger... the elephant has a thicker skin than the individual has a thin skin. And so the individual perhaps responds much more easily to what comes from the outside. The thick skin of the elephant causes a thicker skin there. It's more separated, you see? It's more separated, and so the animal has a longer reflex action. Summarizing, the elephant doesn't reflect the reflex action of an animal... of the elephant is not as fast as man. That summarizes it, okay? So Rustani continues. So the situation is not that the animal thinks like this. Here's this mischievous fellow. He has thrown things at me. I'm going to revenge him and spritz him with water. That's not the sort of thing the elephant does. Not at all. He doesn't go through that thinking process. If the boy threw something at you, you'd immediately hit, you'd immediately sock the kid. You'd do that to him immediately. But the elephant has a much longer reflex action. There's no thinking. You don't think when the boy throws something good, bang, you've got to sock in the jaw, you sock him immediately. The elephant has a similar reflex action. The only point is, it lasts much longer. The elephant is a slower reacting animal because he has a thick skin, and hence it lasts much longer before he responds with his trunk filled of water. But it's still a reflex action, not a thinking action. Now the elephant doesn't take his trunk and immediately take his trunk and hit the mischievous boy with it. No. The elephant notices that when, in the intermediate period, when he drinks, but when water enters into his trunk, he realizes then his trunk becomes stronger. That strengthens his trunk. He wants to make his trunk stronger. And through the fact that there is water in the trunk becomes longer. It is simply the lengthened trunk which he wants to really hit the boy one when he spritz out a trunk full of water on the boy. That's the sort of way you must understand the behavior of the elephant. You must not ascribe to the elephant human wisdom, but you have to enter into the whole soul mood of the elephant, and then you'll find just what I told you. And so indeed with the elephant, you have an inwardly self-enclosed being and notices everything, and he in most notices what goes on within his being. And so the elephant is a person who knows what goes on in his inner being, and so because he was much more circumscribed, more enclosed, the thick skin encloses it, he knows what's going on more in his inside being, and so he can prophesy the approach of death and then go back into the cave to die. Vasana continues. Now you see, it is so that it indeed exists in a very little degree an animal psychology. When you observe the animals and you find, as I have just told you, you can find all kinds of interesting things. However, the actual being able to perceive and go into the animal soul, that is something which today is extraordinary seldom. However, one must, if one wants to arrive at these things, strengthen your senses, your sense, in order to be able to observe life completely. If you go to quite small animals, as they also exist, there are quite small animals which consist in the main only out of a soft slimy mass. This soft slimy mass, it can, when it approaches in the vicinity of a granule of corn, stretch out of its soft slimy mass something like a feeler. There is formed a sort of arm out of this soft slimy mass, and then the arm can then recede itself. But you see, such animals separate themselves chalk or silica scales. They separate chalk or silica so that they are surrounded by a scale, a shell of chalk or silica. Now, in such a small animal which separates chalk or silica, one can still observe much. But then there exist still more perfected animals, and one can notice much more with them. There are animals which exist out of such a slimy mass, but there within is something which, when one observes accurately, it has the appearance of small rays. And then around these small rays there is a shala, a shell, and in the shell there are stings, pricks, stacheln, pricks. Everything which then grows out to be like corals, that's how they appear. So you see, gentlemen, you take such an animal that has a skin, has a shala, a scale, with pricks, with stings, pricks, and inwardly it has its soft mass, and in its soft mass it has this radiating structure. What is it? Well, when one really investigates, so you find that these ray-strahlen, these rays in the inner of it, are not produced by the earth, but these rays which are within the slimy mass which was surrounded by the shell, these inner rays are not produced by the earth, but they are produced by the stars. The soft mass is acted upon from out of the heaven, and the hard mass, or the mass with the pricks coming out of it, that is caused by the inner part of the earth. Now, how does a situation arise like that? If you want to know how it arises, so you conceive of the following: that here is a stuction, here's a piece of the thing, and I'm just drawing it in a very magnified way. Here is a stuction of such a slimy animal. Now there forms itself here, through a penetrating star effect, inwardly, there forms such a ray, inwardly. Through the fact that this ray forms, the pressure, the rest of the mass has a rather strong pressure. This, however, presses itself stronger on the wall, and because of that, there forms itself there within on the scale, because that presses stronger, a very strong bulge, a strong Ausbuchtung, a strong projection. You have a prick, a Stachel, something that pricks, a sting, or whatever it is, of the surrounding chalk or silica mass. So, from the outside, from the earth, you get the Stachel, and from the in, the working in of the star. Can you all understand that? Steiner certainly goes a long way round to explain that when these lower animals you have in the soft mass, and in the soft mass that's worked upon by the stars, the soft mass is surrounded by a scale. The outside of the scale are Stachel, those are things, protuberances, and these protuberances are worked by the earth. That's what he's saying here. Now Rudolf Steiner goes a stage further. Now that which forms within, that is the beginning of a nerve mass. And that which forms on the outside, that's the beginning of a bone mass. So that with these lower animals, one can see that nerves form themselves under the influence of the external cosmic environment, that which is external to the earth. And everything that which is of a bony, scaly nature, as you know, the lower animals just have an exterior bones, everything of this bony nature that forms itself under the inworking of the earth. Of the more perfect animals, the more it is that you don't get, there is an ending of the Schalenbildung, there's an ending of the scale formation, and instead of that, you have the formation of the skeleton, which is then, in the most perfect way, present in the human being. But just regard the human skeleton. If you regard the human skeleton, then you come to the fact of actually being able to compare your head with a lower animal, because the head has a kind of scale outside, a schala, and inwardly the head is soft. In the inner of the head, it's soft. And this is a great difference between the rest of the bony structure of the human being. Your leg bones, you carry your leg bones inwardly, and the leg bones are covered up by flesh. There, the outside mass is soft. There, man has taken into himself the bony skeleton. Now, this fact that the external bone skeleton is not like the head, but in the rest of the human being taken into itself, this is connected with the fact that the blood with these higher animals and in with man is in a certain way developed. If you observe such lower animals, so is everything a white mass. Also that which in the lower animals runs as blood is white. These lower animals thus actually have white blood and not warm blood. The higher the animals become, and the more with the animal organization we approach the human being, the more is the human being who remains light, the more is the human being permeated by a blood mass. And the more the nerves permeate the blood mass, the more draws itself the skeleton, which previously was an external scale, the more this skeleton withdraws itself back into the inner of the organism. Now here, if you can stand the long drawn out description, is a most interesting observation, I think, series of observations. Rothsteiner continues, so one can say, why has the man inwardly configurated bones like with his arms and his legs? And the answer is, because he has permeated his nerve mass by blood mass. So that one can say the following. Inwardly, higher animals and man need the blood inwardly in order that they can take into themselves the external scale. Can you all understand that? You see, with that indeed one can say that such a lower animal, that doesn't know very much of itself. Man, however, and the higher animals do know about themselves. How is it that man knows about himself? Man knows about himself through the fact that man has within himself the bony structure. Because of that, man knows about himself. Thus, when one asks the following question, indeed, through which then has man actually his self-consciousness? Through which is man able to know himself? Then one must not point to the muscles, one must not point to the soft portions, but one must precisely point to the solid bony structure, bony frame. Through the possession of the solid bony frame, man knows of himself. And the situation is this, that it is extraordinarily interesting precisely to observe the bony frame of man. Just consider, here you have man, and I am very coarsely drawing again, putting in his bony system. Now, it's extraordinarily interesting. If you observe a skeleton, so you must conceive of the fact that this skeleton was within the human being. But this skeleton of the man was quietly überzogen, covered over by a skin. If I were to designate here the skin, I must draw it red. When the human being lives, then his whole bone system is like in a sack. However, a sack which is adapted to it. The bony system actually exists in a skin, the so-called bone skin. The bony system of man, the bone system is like in a sack, and the sack is the bone skin. The bone skin is a sack which holds the bony system. He's talking about the bone skin now, Beinhaut. Thus, just consider here, you have a joint. Here you have a bone with a collar, and that inserts itself into a socket. So it is with the bone skin. There is the bone skin. The whole external bone is surrounded by bone skin. And that goes further, and there the bone skin goes further. Again, it comes here, and Rudolf Steiner is drawing something on the board. It goes over the skeleton, and you have the bone skin. Thus, when you simply conceive of the skeleton in the human being, so you can see that the skeleton is quite separated off in the human being. Between all the rest of the portions of the body of man and the skeleton, there is a sack-kind skin. It is really so if you would take the skeleton of the living human being and you would think to yourself, you spread all over the skeleton a sack, and then you put it in the sack, and then outside of the that the sack is covering over the skeleton. Now this you don't have to make, because nature's already made it. The whole thing is steckt in a sack, a Beinhaut. It uses two words, I think to me they mean the same thing, a Beinhaut and a Knochenhaut. Knochen is bone, Bein is a leg, so let's call it the bone skin. And he continues, the bone skin, he says, the interesting thing is this, that the blood vessels, they only go right to the Beinhaut. And the Beinhaut, the bone skin, or the leg skin, I'm sure it means the bone skin, because Bein can mean leg or a bone. Why the bloody hell he uses Knochen once and Bein another to mean the same thing, the Lord only knows, I don't. Maybe it's just to confuse me or to put me into trouble. Anyway, he used Beinhaut. Maybe find out yourself whether Beinhaut, Beinhaut, is different from a Knochenhaut, Knochenhaut. According to the dictionary here, Bein can mean a leg or a bone. So there it is. Why use a bloody bone tooth? Okay, let's go on. So we reach this point. The interesting thing is that the blood vessels only go towards the bone skin. The bone skin is davon durchzogen. Durchzogen means to permeate through. We have the situation that the blood vessels, they go only towards the bone skin and they permeate the bone skin. This blood is nourished. This blood nourishes, as far as it can be nourished, the bones. So you have the bones, surrounding the bones, the bone skin. The blood vessels go not into the bones, but into the bone skin. And it, within the sac is, and within the sac, the bone is completely of an earthy nature. Carbonates, phosphates, calcium phosphates, calcium carbonates, ashes, salts, etc. So the bone itself is completely earth. Surrounding the bone, you have the bone skin. Permeating the bone skin are the blood vessels. Now you've got the picture, very simple picture. So now you have the remarkable fact. You are thus muscles, liver, and you have in yourself the blood vessels. And in the blood, there forms itself, in the first place, a sac. And the sac closes itself inwards. Within this sac is a whole realm, a space. But in this space is within it the bone structure, the bone framework. So it is really so as if you are stecking, as if your bones are sticking inside of you, and you have your bones abgeschlossen, cut off through a sac, and the sac being the bone skin. And these bones, gentlemen, are quite earthy. Inwardly, you are inner earth, but you cannot perceive yourself inwardly. You perceive your bones through that which they are bones, just as little as if you would take a piece of chalk. If you take a piece of chalk, you don't perceive the piece of chalk. The chalk is outside you. In a similar way, the bones are outside you, and you are separated from the bones by a sac. So you see, all of you in your skeleton, you have something in yourself which is not yourself, something which is the earth formed in a bone form, calcium phosphate, salt, calcium carbonate. That you carry in yourself, but only that is surrounded by a sac, the bone skin. This amazes me. He spent almost a page and a half describing something which is so bloody simple. I finally get it. Only through the grace of God I got it. Watson continues. You see, this is not the place for something of an unspiritual nature. Because if you bring some if you bring into yourself some kind of earth splinter, what you get are abscesses. Your bones don't cause you abscess. I've got the point. What is science trying to say is now, if you get a splinter in your skin from the outside, you get an abscess. And the outside, if a piece of earth comes into your skin, you get an abscess. But you carry a whole bloody earth inside of your bone skin. Your bones are earth. Why don't they cause an abscess? Now we have the answer. Because of that place where you in yourself are dead, where the bones within your bone skin works dead, there sits spirit. You see, that is the wonderful instinct why the simple people, which often knew much more than the learned people, have represented death by the skeleton. Because they knew that in the skeleton there sits the spirit. And that's why they represented, whenever a ghost appears, it must appear in the form of a skeleton. That is a correct symbolic representation. because as long as the human being lives, he makes for himself place for the spirit through his bones. This is something which in the near future I will speak more about. But out of all this you can see that man applies a great deal, puts a great deal of attention to bring the spirit into his bones. The elephant permits for the spirit place for the elephant permits place for the spirit in his thick skin. Man permits place for the spirit in his bones. And through the fact that the elephant permits place for the spirit in his thick skin, can the spirit, which the elephant then feels, perceives when the external world disturbs him. Man knows nothing of his death because his skin is too thin. If man had physically a thick skin, so he would also withdraw himself into a cave in order to die in a cave. And people will say, what happens to human beings when they die? They would say, human beings travel up to heaven when they die. Indeed, gentlemen, of those people who in certain circles of people have been very much reverenced, one has said the same thing as one says of an elephant. Though, for example, of Moses, one has said that one has never been able to find his corpse. His corpse disappeared because one has conceived of him that it really occurred, that he had become so wise that people represented to themselves what I've just told you, that you couldn't find the corpse of Moses. If man was physically a thick skin, and, good heavens, man had both a thick skin and a brain, he would be so clever that you couldn't say how clever he'd be. And such connections people knew. Just imagine what people knew. People said of Moses, he was so clever that as if he would have had a thick skin. That's what's said about Moses. I never read that anywhere, but Rudolf Steiner evidently found out that somewhere they said that Moses was so clever as if he had a thick skin. And hence, when he died, he drew himself away and his corpse cannot be found. This is a very interesting connection. Doesn't it appear interesting to you, gentlemen? The old sagas stand a great deal in connection with a purely beautiful worship of animals. Of that thing we will speak further next time if I'm invited and if I get enough time to talk about it. Now here ends the lecture. Well, there's a very new insights from this lecture, but gee, it's tough slugging to go through all these verbosities and all this twisting round and round to say such simple things. God bless you, Rudolf Steiner. God bless you. Thank you at least for telling us these things. We'd never known them. But please, I wish you weren't born in a Teuton. I wish you were born as a Frenchman or an Englishman. It'd been so marvellous because you'd speak in a way that all the Anglos could understand you, and Rick Mansell wouldn't have to battle and get so annoyed when he struggles through the way you present these ideas. God bless you, sir. End of tape. Goodbye.